The Federal Endangered Species List is a long document showing animals and plants either endangered, close to extinction, or threatened, close to being considered endangered. Getting on the list is not supposed to be an end, but a beginning, the start of a process of recovery to eventually get the listed species off the list. And you might have noticed there are frequent disagreements about how best to go about recovery. The Canada lynx, a big cat, is the latest focus of disagreement. Several environmental groups recently went to court to press for more protection for the lynx. John Melgren is an attorney for the Western Environmental Law Center and our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. John, welcome. John Melgren, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Okay, there we go. Thanks for joining us today. Tell us a bit about the lynx, where it lives, and what we know about its numbers.
Sure. Lynx are medium-sized cats. They actually look kind of similar to a bobcat, but are distinctly different. They have very long legs and very large paws and webbed toes, which makes them adapted to walk on snow and gives them a competitive advantage in the snow, which is where they prefer to live. They live in areas with a lot of deep, fluffy winter snow. And their primary prey is snowshoe hares, so they tend to live in areas where snowshoe hares are found. And snowshoe hares also, because of their name, you know, they're named after the fact that they live in areas with this deep, fluffy snow. Canada lynx, they're about 22 pounds, you know, the average adult male, and they tend to live in the northern United States. The largest populations of lynx are actually in Montana and also in Colorado, which recently had a reintroduction effort that reintroduced over 200 lynx into the forests of Colorado. But there are also populations of lynx in Washington and Idaho, Wyoming, and there have been lynx in Oregon as well. A majority of the lynx sightings have been in northeastern Oregon near the Wallawas, but there have been sightings, according to WDFW, in the Willamette Valley and the Cascades near Steens Mountain and the Blue Mountains as well. So, but one problem is that we don't know the full extent of Oregon's lynx population.
Was there a lot of hunting of lynxes? Was there a bounty on them at any time, like there was for wolves, for example?
There has been a lot of trapping of lynx, and lynx pelts are very valuable outside of the United States. It's illegal to have one in the United States. But because lynx and bobcat are very similar, and bobcats can be hunted and trapped, a lot of times there have been several cases in recent years of lynx accidentally getting trapped in bobcat traps.
So it's been listed as threatened for how long now?
It was first listed in 2000.
And it sounds like there have been legal actions at several steps along the way.
There have been. When the lynx was first listed in 2000, then 6 years later in 2006, Fish and Wildlife Service came out with the first critical habitat designation. They then revised that in 2009, and there was a lawsuit over that revised critical habitat designation. And just so you know, critical habitat refers to areas that are very important to a certain threatened or endangered species, and it can either be occupied or unoccupied areas. So the occupied areas, you know, where the Canada lynx is present, and we really need to protect this area to ensure that the lynx can continue to thrive in that area. But then also unoccupied areas where the lynx hasn't made it there yet or it hasn't recovered there, but it's really important to protect that specific habitat so that lynx can one day occupy that area.
So are critical habitat designations generally for areas in which at least historically the critter you're talking about once lived?
Correct. Usually throughout their historic range. And with the lynx, for example, the Fish and Wildlife Service decided to only designate critical habitat in areas that are deemed occupied. So they decided not to designate any critical habitat in unoccupied areas.
All right, so that immediately limits the critical habitat designation anyway, if not necessarily the range. But then what happens within critical habitat? Because I'm sure that this is a big bone of contention between the federal agencies and landowners. What does a critical habitat designation do if it happens to include areas around your land or your land itself?
Certainly. So the critical habitat, it means that you can't disturb that area without consulting with the Fish and Wildlife Service. So if there is critical habitat, you need to get a permit from Fish and Wildlife Service to be able to develop it or alter the landscape. And that's just so that Fish and Wildlife Service can ensure that nothing is happening in those areas that will adversely affect the species that has the critical habitat. However, in most instances, critical habitat doesn't cover private lands. And it sometimes will cover state-owned lands, but not always. In the case of the lynx, the critical habitat is on federally owned lands, so we're talking about Forest Service and BLM lands. And then that does impact the ability of the Forest Service or the Bureau of Land Management to do things like have timber projects or road construction and other things that might alter that habitat.
So this latest legal filing was it Monday a week ago? Monday the 17th?
It was.
Okay, and on behalf of whom and over what?
Sure. The Western Environmental Law Center, are representing a number of conservation organizations, including Wild Earth Guardians, Conservation Northwest, Oregon Wild, and Cascadia Wildlands. And we're specifically suing the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service for what we believe are a number of errors in judgment that they made. Not errors in judgment, but they relied upon inappropriate materials and didn't consider the best available science in reaching their determination. The Endangered Species Act requires that the agency use the best available science and consider all the relevant factors when determining what critical habitat is. And they frankly just did not rely upon the best available science, nor did they consider all the information that was provided to them in the public comment period. And I'll give you an example of that. For instance, since we're talking about Oregon here, the service just flat out ignored Oregon. They said, we're not designating critical habitat in Oregon. We think it's unoccupied. However, there haven't been any recent studies looking at the lynx population in Oregon. They didn't look at any of the habitat to determine, even if it is unoccupied, whether or not we need to be protecting these areas so that lynx can come in and recover within Oregon. And we believe that there is a large amount of habitat in Oregon that may be partially occupied by lynx. We don't have firm information on that because there haven't been any recent studies specific to Oregon. But we believe that a lot of Oregon's forest land in the mountains, especially in northeast Oregon, and maybe even in the Cascades, could provide habitat for lynx, and therefore it's really important to conserve it so that lynx can continue to expand their range and eventually recover and become delisted.
We're talking about delisting potentially the Canada lynx, which is currently listed on the endangered species list as a threatened species. And we're talking to John Milgren, an attorney at the Western Environmental Law Center, about the critical habitat designation by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, which several environmental groups represented by the Western Environmental Law Center find lacking. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we explore the issue further. 800-838-3760, the phone number anywhere in our listening area, 800-838-3760. Our email address, jx@jeffnet.org. So is the issue with the critical habitat primarily where or how much, or is each a function of the other?
They're kind of interrelated. With the most recent decision, the Fish and Wildlife Service designated just under 39,000 square miles of critical habitat across the entire United States, and the majority of that is within the state of Montana. However, we believe that, by looking at these other areas, that would increase the total amount of critical habitat that is protected for lynx.
The designation of critical habitat, and given the fact that the lynx sounds like it lives in pretty high elevation snowy areas, particularly in the lower 48, it's a Canada lynx, but, as you mentioned, a lot of it in Montana where there tends to be more snow. Are these areas that there's much economic activity going on? Is the Forest Service allowing logging in some of the areas that the lynxes would be considered for critical habitat?
They are. And especially in Montana, there has been a lot of litigation over Forest Service timber sales and lynx habitat. So it is definitely an issue. And the primary reason why timber sales are an issue for lynx is that lynx avoid openings, large openings. They like to be in dense forest. It's called multi-storied forest, where there's a lot of horizontal cover so that there is an open sky above them. And so when you go in and clear cut an area, that creates an opening, which then lynx will avoid. So as you log more and more land, you reduce the amount of habitat that lynx can use. And so it's really important that those areas be protected.
What are the predators that would prey on lynx in the wild? I'm just curious to know why they tend to shy away from the uncovered areas.
Sure. It would be larger predators. But to tell you the truth, it really has to do, their habitat really is the biggest threat to the lynx. Protecting the habitat really makes it conducive to, remaining or recovering their populations.
It seems like we have these conversations pretty often, and not just about the lynx, obviously, but several cases that seem to be coming out of the Western Environmental Law Center at any given time about threatened or endangered species, and specifically about critical habitat. Is that a frequent niche that you guys work?
We do a lot of Endangered Species Act work. I was actually on the Jefferson Exchange about a year ago to talk about the wolverine listing, which then became, they didn't list the wolverine. And so we litigate under the Endangered Species Act for not every single species, but we have selected some focal species amongst them, Canada lynx, wild salmon, wolverine, and the northern spotted owl. And those species really are a proxy for general ecosystem health. And they're also very impacted by climate change. And so as climate change is occurring and our landscapes and atmosphere is changing, it's going to have a greater impact on these species that are dependent on things like deep snow or, in the case of salmon, the amount of water coming down off the mountains. So we're very selective in the cases that we bring under the Endangered Species Act because of the broader implications that they have.
I'm curious then, because you just brought up climate change, I mean, what the current state of acknowledgement of climate change within federal courts is, at least within the context of protecting species in areas that that might not support them.
Certainly, it's definitely a big issue, and the federal courts have recognized that climate change is a very big impact on a number of these species, and the question then becomes, well, what can we do about it? An example of that is the wolverine, where Fish and Wildlife Service said that climate change is the biggest threat to the survival of the wolverine in the future, but because climate change is uncertain, we really can't do anything about it, and so they decided not to list the wolverine then because of that. And we believe that that is, at this point in time, the science is very clear. Climate change is happening. We're having less snow at high elevations. It's not lasting as late into the spring and summer as it used to, and this is having a severe impact on endangered and threatened species. And so it really becomes a challenge for conservation groups and I think the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and other government agencies about what they can do to protect these species in the face of climate change, which is not only a local problem, but truly a global problem.
John Milgren, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, an attorney at the Western Environmental Law Center. We're talking about Canada lynx critical habitat. The ongoing discussion, then, that seems to be going on with conservation groups and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service often are about things like the rate at which things are happening under the Endangered Species Act, the amount at which things like critical habitat are being provided. What's the general holdup from your standpoint, why the Fish and Wildlife Service needs to be prodded to deliver the things that clearly in the minds of conservation groups should be automatic?
Well, I think there's a number of factors at play. One issue is there is a lot of political pressure on the Fish and Wildlife Service. They are getting pressure from elected officials in Congress, from state elected officials, from state legislatures, and so they're getting a lot of that pressure. And then additionally, a problem at all levels of government is just basic funding, and the Fish and Wildlife Service truly is taking a hit in terms of their funding. And because they don't have the manpower to do everything that the Endangered Species Act requires of them, it's just they can't do it all. And so it becomes necessary then to sue them, to force them to take these actions. And it is really a challenge for conservation groups and the government to work in a world that is constrained by, the funding pressures and political pressures and, trying to deal with all of these different dynamics. When at the end of the day, I think, we and the groups that I represent and the Fish and Wildlife Service, for the most part, we all agree that we want to protect these species and recover them to the point where they are no longer listed and no longer putting those constraints on land management because the species is so prolific and has truly recovered. Go ahead.
We've gotten into situations, though, particularly with things like the western sage grouse, where you get a finding from the Fish and Wildlife Service that listing is warranted, but they defer the listing. What's the usual mechanical thing going on there?
And usually that is just a funding decision. They recognize that a listing is warranted, but they just don't have the manpower to do the work immediately, and so they put the decision off. And, you know, and a good example of that is actually related to lynx, where under the Endangered Species Act, when a species is listed, the Fish and Wildlife Service has to create something called a recovery plan. And the recovery plan is a document that's supposed to guide how that species is going to eventually become delisted and the actions that need to be taken and what needs to be protected in order to make that happen. But for lynx, for example, we actually had to sue the Fish and Wildlife Service last year in 2013. And we won that case because the Fish and Wildlife Service had not completed that recovery plan, and a court in Montana ordered the Fish and Wildlife Service to complete that recovery plan here within the next 3 years, so that we have some certainty as to what actions we can actually take on the ground to protect and ultimately recover and delist the Canada lynx.
Are there efforts going on among the environmental groups you represent to get a hold of members of Congress and say, look, you need more funding for the Fish and Wildlife Service to be able to do its job, in addition to the efforts to make sure that their feet are held to the fire through the courts, through legal action?
Yes, there are. My clients routinely are in Washington, D.C., lobbying on behalf of the species and to ensure that the government agencies have sufficient funding to fulfill their mandate that Congress, through the Endangered Species Act, has imposed upon them.
So through this latest legal action from a week ago with the Canada lynx, what happens now? What are the next steps? Do you get a hearing within the next month, the next 3 months, something?
It'll actually probably be a several-year process. Now that we've filed the lawsuit, we're waiting for the Fish and Wildlife Service to compile all of the documents that were the basis for its decision, which it will submit to the court. Then we'll brief out the legal issues for the judge and ultimately have a hearing. The lawsuit was filed in Missoula, Montana, in front of Judge Christensen, so we will likely have an oral argument in front of him. And I would imagine that probably sometime in 2016, we will know the fate of the critical habitat designation.
You mentioned the areas in Oregon where you're looking for some lynx habitat designation. Would the Cascades be involved in that at all, or are we just talking northeastern Oregon?
The Cascades would definitely be a part of that.
All right. John Milgren is an attorney at the Western Environmental Law Center, representing several environmental groups in suing the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to get further action on protecting the Canada lynx. John Milgren, thanks for joining us again on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you, and have a good day.
All right, take care. That'll do it for this hour of The Exchange. Deborah Zaslow will join us in hour number two to talk about her memoir of caring for her 103-year-old grandmother in the final days. Bringing Bubby Home is the book coming up.